So the paper suggests
suggest?
Darn it, I don't know what it suggests. Welcome to the Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So Marlene, we are finally out of beta.
Yes, thankfully.
And by that, I mean the tropical storm, not like we're some software that's coming out of beta.
Oh, I know what you mean. My backyard knows what you mean.
Yeah, well, I don't know about you, but I could use a little sunshine. Mm-hmm. You know, to be honest, I would much rather have the inconvenience of being just a little bit soggy from the tropical storm than having those wildfires that they're having out west. So, yeah. I'll take the rain and best of luck to the people out west that are enduring those wildfires.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's jump right into this week's information inspirations. Marlene, we've talked about major litigation funding before on the podcast with the likes of Scott Mazarski and recently with Legal Value Network webinar that I attended on the subject. It was really interesting.
There.
But I saw two stories this week about a new funding company called Law As You Go, which claims to help fill the access to justice gap by creating a line of credit to individuals needing legal assistance.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to come right out and say that my initial reaction to this story, which ran both in the Artificial Lawyer and the Legal Examiner the past couple of days, is that, you know, there's a sea of red flags that are going on here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has this feel of a cross between a payday loan company and a bail bonds operation, you know, and those are perfectly legal businesses. But, you know, we all know that they have some serious issues, which, tend to create a lot of residual issues, you know, for people who are financially vulnerable.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we know that we have an access to justice problem in the United States. There's just no doubt about that. You know, and the issue is that people just can't afford the high cost of justice that, you know, and that's a big obstacle in the legal system. So being able to finance that cost could be a reasonable approach on helping people obtain justice. This type of operation, however, you know, seems to come with a lot of questions that I would like to see answered before I would view it as a reasonable approach to an A to J issue.
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, there would have to be a lot more transparency as to how this works and how it's explained to those who are going to use the service what their liabilities are for it. Well, Greg, our friends Brian Parker and John Greenblatt at Legal Innovators have come out with a white paper, and it's highlighting how to achieve meaningful diversity and inclusion in the legal industry. They start out with highlighting the state of the legal industry, and you can cue up the sad music.
Yeah, I can kind of envision what the state of the legal industry is right now.
Yeah, so not surprisingly, the industry has been slow to embrace diversity. And the 2008 recession disproportionately impacted attorneys of color. So it set levels back, and it's taken a decade to recover that ground.
Yeah.
The report also notes that there's higher attrition rates by females and racially and ethnically diverse lawyers from law firms. And if you just get onto Twitter, you can hear all of the reasons why people left.
Twitter's a good place to find out all the reasons.
it's like the after dark, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like the after dark.
Yep.
So many in 2020 are worried that they're going to see a repeat of diversity and inclusion goals receding. And so what they're talking about is what's the business case for it? So they note a McKinsey report finds a solid business case for increasing diversity. But, you know, what we've seen is turning aspirational talk into action has remained a problem. And the issue of diversity fatigue, which I did not know was a thing until I read this, is real. There's real burnout about how to recruit and retain racially and ethnically diverse and female talent. So they talk about how do we move this needle? And they go a little bit into the history of it. So, you know, the ABA has made recommendations for reforms, including areas of planning, culture, assessment, and accountability. So Sherman and Sterling, way back in 1997, had a partnership with the NAACP to attract aspiring candidates that were unlikely to go into corporate law. But firms still have not succeeded in making a model where diversity is sustained. The paper suggests that a practical way to sustain diversity and inclusion efforts is to make it a business imperative and to consistently measure and report results. Culture needs to be addressed so talent feels included and valued. Good culture also has to concern itself with the life cycle of talent management. So the hiring, development, promotion. So the white paper is great. A lot of research has gone into this, and Legal Innovators lays out their model and, you know, how it supports the case for helping law firms. And in addition to deep content, it has really easily digestible infographics. So take a look forward to your HR or talent management, recruitment, or D&I teams.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned there is the, you know, worry, and you see it in some of the current federal government educational programs in some of the rules now, is this backlash against D&I training. So that type of what did you call it? Diversity fatigue.
Yes.
Yeah, is real. So had to be very careful, because this is not something that we need to be fatigued about. Mm-hmm. All right. So I have a quick one to wrap it up. So Business Insider had this article that caught my attention, and it caught my attention because it was a little clickbaity in the title. Ooh. So first of all, I want to read the wording of the link that I saw and see if it grabs your attention too. So here's the link. Female partners in big law make $332,000 less than male partners on average, but one change has been shown to increase women's salaries by more than 40% and boost their happiness as well. Did that grab your attention? I want to know what that one change is.
That's good. I got to say, it's like, I want to click.
I know. Well, there's some really good information that's been gathered by the recruiting firm of Lindsay Africa and Major in their salary survey. And I think they do this every other year. The one thing that boosts pay and happiness for female partners, I'll go ahead and jump in that, and so you don't have to click
drum
on
roll.
It. So the one thing is kind of good and bad, and that is that they need to move to another firm.
Bingo. So yeah. What did I just talk about? Like, yep. Oh yeah, people leave. Why do they leave? To go someplace else.
Go someplace else. So again, while it may not be a shocker to many of us, you know, in a way it is, it's very sad that law firms can't do better at finding ways of keeping talent and appropriately paying the talent, especially if that talent is historically underpaid and underappreciated. So,
yeah, you know, it's interesting because I, you know, when I'm on Twitter, I see some of these people talking about why they've left firms, and a lot of them just go out and start their own because, you know, how they feel that the culture is so sort of unaccepting and unwelcoming.
Yeah.
And that wraps up this week's Information Inspirations. Olga Mack is the CEO of Parley Pro, a next-gen contract management company that has pioneered online negotiation technology. If you haven't seen her LinkedIn posts, you absolutely should. Let's hit the interview. Today we have a very special guest. Olga Mack is the CEO of Parley Pro, a next-gen contract management company that has pioneered online negotiation technology. She's presented at TEDx on how smart contracts will change the world and several webinars and podcasts on why corporations need women on their boards. In 2019, she received the Agents of Change Award from Diablo Magazine. In 2020, the Women of Influence Award from the San Francisco Business Journal. And most recently, she was inducted into the Fast Case 50 this year. Olga, thank you very much for being on the show.
Marlene, it's fantastic and exciting to be here. Thank you for inviting. And Greg, it's great to be with you again.
Well, it's good to have you here. So, Olga, I mean, you've got an arm's length of awards that you've done, but can you give us a little bit about your journey to where you are professionally?
Yeah, I'm what you would describe a tech lawyer by design. I immigrated to the United States when I was 13 and in the middle of Silicon Valley, and have observed my family change and transform through technology, through the opportunity that it provided. Both of my parents are engineers, and I just had a little bit of pressure to become one. And when it became completely apparent that I cannot spend my entire day in front of the computer, I decided to go to law school. I wanted to be on the forefront of technology. I wanted to shape policy. And I wanted to have people and companies to really be on this digital journey. When I went to law school, I basically studied intellectual property, security, and privacy. I saw a very classic training for a tech lawyer. After law school, I joined Wilson Sonsini as a patent security privacy litigator. And then at some point, I went in-house. My first in-house job was at Visa Inc., the Fortune 500 company. And that's when my traditional career ended, and I ran away with a circus called Startups. And I joined Zeus, which is an online dating company, as a number two lawyer. And I was there trying to help the company to go public. I was then recruited to be the general counsel of ClearSlide, which is online and sales engagement platform. And my job was to help the company be acquired. And I've helped on the journey for about 3 years. After that, I joined as VP of Strategy of a Y Combinator company called QuantStamp, and my job was to help to build products, protocols, and partnerships. And that's when Parler Pro came into my life. Parler Pro has approached me to join as a CEO because I've been a former general counsel, because I've been on the cutting edge of technology, and because I deeply care about the future of law, especially as it relates to the in-house community. I've had numerous conversations with the in-house community through my writing, through my webinars, through my speaking, about technology aspects of the future of law, skills aspects of the future of law, and frankly, emotional preparedness as we're seeing the future of law, the way it's practiced in-house and other areas, change right in front of our eyes.
What a shame that you've had such a boring career.
I was going to say.
I really like to be predictable.
Well, Olga, I know you have your finger in your fingers in many pots. So there's a lot of things that we could talk about. But what we're going to focus on for the podcast today is the importance of attorneys taking care of themselves. And you've recently been posting a lot about the importance of this. So things like, you know, mentioning, you know, lack of sleep is not an act of heroism and thinking about the stress from having to act in a way that's expected rather than being genuine, being chained to a desk. And I think that's particularly stressful now, you know, if people have to go back to the office, eating poorly, not exercising, you know, the list goes on. How the heck did we get to this place, and what do we need to do to reverse course?
That's a very good question. You know, got to law school. Somebody once told me that being a lawyer is 1,000-year-old path, and to be successful, you have to keep going on it. And otherwise, you're sort of on your own, and the wolves and the sharks will eat you. I've been told that basically in the beginning of law school, and it sort of fueled the desire to change law. From the day one, the way we practice it, the way we consume it, the relationship we have, both as professionals and as recipients of that advice. One of the things that we accept for granted is how much we push lawyers to the limits, how much we don't train them to be, you know, good humans first, good, take care of themselves. And how we really worship on a pedestal of law. But I think law cannot be divorced from humanity. When we talk about concepts of justice and doing the right thing, and law is very related, doing justice to yourself is important. And unlike business schools where you spend 2 years, in law school we spend 3. That's a lot of time. We have plenty of time to teach future lawyers how to be human first, how to take care of themselves, how to contribute to society, and frankly, how to be a good lawyer. So law school is long enough, and somehow we fail to teach 80% of what's important. And it shows in amount of anxiety. Numerous folks have written and spoken about it, and how many lawyers exit this profession, and just general dissatisfaction. You know, what I, in my transition to on the business side, which actually was not all that intentional, I was a very, very happy lawyer. I really enjoyed practice of law. It just sort of happened. What struck me as very remarkable is when folks have told me that I'm a recovering lawyer. And that does not sound good. It made it sound like law somehow was a bad choice, or it was just an indiscretion, or some sort of addiction. And I assure you, it was none of those things. I was a very happy lawyer. But a lot of people feel this way. There's a reason why we use words of addiction to describe practice of law, and that has to change.
So you've posted recently, and I think maybe somewhat controversially, that lawyers are not as risk averse as everyone seems to claim that they are. What about this particular topic, especially like with self-care? Do you think that they're risk averse on this issue?
I think with self-care, I think an education will go a long way. I don't think it's a question of risk so much, really. I think it is the baseline expectation and education and giving tools to take care of yourself.
Well, let me follow up on that. What kind of, if you could be the leader of a law school and you had, you know, 1L, 2L, or 3L, what would you inject into the system that would help?
Oh, so many things.
Where do I start?
So many things. I mean, in fact, I taught at Berkeley Law, and none of them were traditional subjects. I was teaching financial statements, leadership, and design thinking. I think those are great additions. But specifically to taking care of yourself, a really great class that I sat through once is by the author of Anxious Lawyer, Gina Chu. And she led, you know, very hardcore litigators through the meditation exercise. She asked everyone to close their eyes. That is not a common ask, you know, for lawyers. And then very calmly, in her soft voice, proceeded to a very different conversation. And then she asked everyone to open their eyes. And I saw how they looked at the world differently, like right in front of my eyes. That is something that would be useful to teach to law students. You know, when you see this really hardcore lawyers who argue all day long and on top of their license and no case law, first law, the idea of closing their eyes right in the middle of the day in the big round table. And then, Jess, you can tell how they enjoyed life so much better after that exercise. It was so visible. It was unforgettable. It's things like that. And I think if you show, lawyers are some of the smartest people I know. If you show them a better way, if you show them technology, if you show them skills, if you show them tools, they'll use them.
So I want to get back to the expectations comment that you made a little bit earlier. So, you know, I think on a certain level, legal organizations and maybe more specifically big law, you know, they want their practitioners to be healthy and happy. You know, they don't want them to be miserable. But, you know, at the same time, leadership is faced with an economic issue that revenue has to keep coming in to keep the lights on. So how do they facilitate this health conscious working environment and still keep a focus on the bottom line?
I think I'm going to say something that may be a little controversial.
Please do.
I'm going to inject some drama. You know, look, big law. I was at a big law. And actually, I was in big law right at the time of last recession. And a couple of things, you know, so long as you tie your profit to hours, your intentions may be good in terms of helping your lawyers to thrive. But I think if you tie profits to hours, your business model has to depend on overworking people.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Like, since we're all still married to the billable hour, how do we get around that?
There are many ways to get around it. And sometimes it is the easier way to bill, but a lot of times it's not necessary. There are ways to structure legal services. Mm-hmm. My plumber doesn't charge me by the hour. My gardener does not charge me by the hour. They could, but that incentivizes them to look for efficient ways to add value to my household.
And they have a sense of what it costs. Like, they have a sense of how long it's going to take. And right. So they can price accordingly, you know, based on that.
That's right. But they're also incentivized to look for efficient ways to add value to my household, right? They're also incentivized to work with me and be open-minded. So, I do think that maybe in some narrow circumstances, hourly rate may be easier, but not every time. You really don't have to charge hourly to add a lot of value to your clients. I think if we change this model largely or completely, that will force us to look for efficiencies. I think technology is going to be a big chunk of it. Look for ways to measure value as opposed to hours. That's a very crude way. I used to joke at a law firm, me telling you how many hours I work makes me feel a little bit objectified. It's a little bit like describing Olga in pounds and height. There's just a whole lot more to Olga than how much I weigh and how tall I am. So I do think that we can and we should find the value of legal services. And I think changing the focus from hours to value will really demonstrate how much value most lawyers give to businesses, to humans. And I think that will change the reputation of lawyers. Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, we talked about how we take care of ourselves, but with this profession, it's very confrontational. And so a lot of times we don't necessarily treat each other very well. And I was thinking of, you had shared an amazing story about how you were working as a prosecutor in court while being almost 9 months pregnant, and the judge asking you in front of the court how you plan to handle your cases.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in. Like, your response here was brilliant. So I hope you share it for the listeners. You know, the judge may have not meant anything by this, but, you know, it was viewed as okay. And it's not okay. You know, bad behaviors notoriously tolerated in law firms, you know, big stakes, high pressure. How do we do better?
Yeah, very, very interesting. I was fortunate enough to be part of the justice program where I spent half a year in San Francisco DA's office under Kamala to prosecute cases. And that's where I had an experience of doing 30 trials. They were not trials of the century. Many of them were possessions and DUIs. But for a young, ambitious lawyer, seeing the courtroom was a really big deal. And I've learned so much doing everything from arraignments to various motion practices to doing trials. And I grew up in San Francisco. I know San Francisco very well. I immigrated when I was 13. And I even had to be a DA for someone who I knew growing up. I really understand the problems of the city, a big city, and how some people get lost in this world. And my very first case, I was very excited about it. Was a case of stolen goods from a store in downtown. I was over preparing just like every lawyer would for a trial. And I might have been a little nervous, but I was super excited. And I was also visibly pregnant. I was 9 months pregnant. In fact, I gave birth the day after we got a verdict. So I was pretty big. And then the judge was looking at me with a lot of curiosity. And then at some point, he's a well-respected judge. He said, Madam DA, I always wanted to ask you how your being pregnant affects your ability to prosecute the case. You know, I didn't really think about it. I just sort of said, hey, my stomach grows, but my brain stays the same. I really wish it were the other way around. I wasn't trying to be brash. I did not know how to answer that question. That's the first thing that came to my mind. I'm also pretty honest and truthful. You know, if you want to know how I'm doing, I'm going to tell you exactly how I'm doing. I think it kind of led to a pregnant pause in the middle of a courtroom. And then we just sort of proceeded as if nothing happened. But, I do believe he did not necessarily come from a bad place. I think he was probably curious. Being, the public defender was a male, the judge being a male, being a young, pregnant woman, and as that in front of a jury, where you probably don't necessarily want to be seen as weak as a prosecutor. Yes, I was a little threatened, and maybe that's why I was a little brash. But I often look back on that comment and that question. I don't believe he meant it in a bad way. I do believe that the question didn't make me comfortable. But I think we could educate sensitivity. That's another thing we can teach in law school. Heck, we can even teach, judges go through a lot of training. We can teach judges through training.
This is good. We're putting together all new classes for law schools, yeah. Just in this podcast. So that's good.
I have to say, I really enjoy that Olga injected pregnant pause into that story.
Yes.
I'll be honest with you. Pause is actually sometimes more powerful than my words.
Yes.
Sometimes exactly. When people say funny things, it's this extra few seconds of stare that will send a very strong message.
And like the sensitivity training is a great idea because, you're dealing with many kind of type A folks who, perhaps that's sort of not their first focus in terms of, working. It's really kind of getting things done and getting the project done and being successful. But being trained to kind of stop and think about what kind of impact that you're having on, the community around you, I think would be very valuable.
Yeah, I in-house, the behavior that is rewarded is actually much less confrontational.
Interesting.
I've spent most of my career in-house, and I would say you can thrive in-house, in most in-house positions on the legal side, if you don't prioritize collaboration. I definitely think that my ability to collaborate, focus on adding value to the business, to the stakeholders, to the department, has been ingrained and polished in my in-house practice. When I graduated from law school, like I didn't know a whole lot about my options in law. That's something we can educate lawyers about too. Because, folks ask me what kind of lawyer I would like to be, and I've never been any kind of lawyer. So it's a really hard question to answer. And one of the things I couldn't imagine is going in-house. And I have to say, the first year in house was an eye-opening. After being at a big law and after being a prosecutor for half a year, it's a very different world. And the soft skills, the collaborative abilities are much, much, much more important. Your legal skills are definitely table stakes. And you succeed in that world, both internally in your legal department and externally with your clients by being a really good team player.
Well, that's certainly, that's good to know and certainly good for the listeners to know. COVID has been stressful for all of us and, but perhaps it's given us a jump start on understanding that careers aren't static. Maybe we've learned along the way there's a basis for a different approach or different work or different goals. So what advice would you offer for those practitioners who want to be, you know, their more modern version, like the attorney 3.0?
Look, I've written a lot about it and I'm happy to sort of share my views about it, because I do think that in the end of the day has to change quite a lot. We are very rigid. We think of swim lanes, and those swim lanes are not, you know how swim lanes are just kind of beads? In the yep. legal world, they're concrete. they're not made
they
of,
are the, they're like the ends of the pool.
Yeah, you cannot jump over. It's very granular, right? The swim lanes are rigid. They're not just rigid in between legal world and business world. You, up until recently, have seen very few lawyers to go from this legal world to business world. Yet, if you look in the business world, somebody who is a marketer could easily be a product person, could easily become a sales professional, could easily then become a customer success person. This is a much more fluid business world. In law, there is a big concrete wall. That is like lane number one. But even if you look within law, you know, the number one question I'm asked, because I've done what's seen in law as lots of pivots. I've been a litigator. I went in-house at a Fortune 500 company. I went down to a startup. Then I've become a general. I never had the same job twice. And in law, those are seen as big pivots. Because people somehow, when I was applying in-house, people would tell me, you're a litigator. You never negotiated contracts. Well, at some point, I never talked. And at some point, I wasn't a lawyer. Contract negotiators are not born, they're made. When I was applying for general counsel position, people would tell me, you've never been a general counsel. Well, I've never been a lot of things before, right? At some point, somebody has to give me my first. And that pivot, if you talk to lawyers who go from litigation to corporate, to from big law to in-house to government to general counsel, this pivots are hard. And a lot of it is because we think that they're different skills and you can't learn. And yet that makes no sense. Some of the smartest people I know are lawyers. You give them a learning opportunity, they will devour. They spend their entire career jumping through hoops of increasing difficulty. And all of those hoops require learning. Yet somehow, when they become lawyers, we pretend that they're completely incapable of learning and tell them that if you happen to choose to be a litigator, you cannot be a corporate lawyer. That makes no sense. That absolutely makes no sense. Somebody asked me once why I became a litigator. Well, I'll be honest with you. I had no plans to become a litigator. I love reading, writing, and arguing, but I do not like making other people's life miserable. I do not like winning on discovery. And I think a lot of law cases are won on discovery. So why did I become a litigator? Very simple. I graduated from law school in 2006 as the corporate work was diminishing. And my law firm told me quite bluntly, Olga, you're very welcome. You think you're talented. We would love you to join the law firm as a litigator. Otherwise, you're on your own. You can practice IP, just not transactional, on the litigation side. And I've spent about 3.5 years proving to myself what I already know, that I do not want to be a litigator, right? And then it was very ironic that after 3.5 years, when I was looking for opportunities to, you know, I finally acknowledged to myself that, you know, I'm done with proving to myself that I do not want to be a litigator and I want to go in-house. Then I got another obstacle. Olga, you cannot become a corporate lawyer because you spent 3.5 years being a litigator. This makes no sense. This makes no sense. We should allow much more fluidity within law and, frankly, across disciplines from law. I've seen lawyers in product roles, in sales roles, in customer success roles, in all kinds of roles, and not just in legal tech, in other disciplines. And they're capable. They're absolutely capable. If they're interested and willing to learn, they're capable, some of the smartest people I know, and they can succeed in any field.
Now, you have mentioned that you practiced during the last downturn, and I know There's a lot of anxiety, especially from some of the younger attorneys, and specifically amongst those who graduated this year and are finding all these challenges, just, you know, barriers on entry into the market right now. With your experience and understanding what's going on now, what would you advise for someone just starting out to kind of curtail some of that anxiety that they're feeling right now?
I can absolutely relate to that anxiety. I was a very junior lawyer at a big law firm as my class was shrinking. And the law firms at the time were not as honest about that they were shrinking it. They were talking about performance. Somehow all my friends' mothers had cancer and they were no longer practicing law. I found that the person on the right office was empty one day, the person on the left. And being a junior person and a young lawyer and just a young human, it's a scary place, especially because in the United States, in law, our identity is very closely tied to our trade. You know, every conversation you have with a stranger will likely end up, what do you do for a living, in one shape or another? Some people will ask you that overtly, others will ask you kind of more diplomatically. But basically, that is something that everybody will ask you. Our identities, who we are as people, very much, especially in law, but frankly, just in our society, revolve around what we do day every day in providing services or building products. So during that recession, so number one, being in a place where you don't know things are happening is just very eerie. Number two, I made a lot of observation, is that in that downturn, there was a number of high profile lawyers who were either laid off and unfortunately, there was a number of suicides. I think it shows to you that one, about our identity, and two, that lawyers are probably not equipped to take care of themselves, especially when their identity is challenged. Those are skills that need to be taught at law school. We need to, economic turbulence, environmental turbulence are becoming normal. We need to have skills to seek help when we need it. So with respect to how, what do I think works? Because I definitely, I made a transition in house during a bad economy when everybody told me that it was impossible. I think one is that I realized that everything I have is right here. There are many ways to learn and nobody can take your skills away. You acquire skills and they are transferable things. And you can pack them with you, your reputation, your skills, and your determination. Those are yours to give, no matter what you did before, whether you had a job or not. And so I went on the mission to acquire skills. And that's how I made my transition in-house. Because everybody told me I never negotiated a contract, I found a way to negotiate contracts. I sat down, I asked my friends to share 40 contracts, I compared them, I created an outline, not all that different that I would create in law school. And when somebody told me that I had no idea what I'm talking about, actually contracts are a very finite universe. Every contract has about 20 clauses. There's about, 10 to 20 variations of every clause. And if you look at about 40 to 400 contracts, I guarantee you will know quite a lot. And then I was on the board to later become a general counsel of a nonprofit in arts. I deeply care about arts. I'm a trained artist. And I practiced that negotiation. By the time I was interviewing at Visa, and they were looking at my very litigation-driven resume and trying to suggest to me that I've never seen a contract, I could have a very robust discussion about contract negotiations. Just through self-learning and small practice. And so I do think that in this chicken and egg problem where you don't get a job because you don't have a skill, you don't have a skill because you don't have a job, sometimes my advice is to solve for the skill and be very creative. You have a lot of control. Lawyers are some of the smartest people I know. they can learn. They can find very creative ways to learn. Self-learning is absolutely the way to do it. Volunteering and other. There's zillion other ways. I see very senior lawyers learning business through being advisory members for startups. That is absolutely a way to do it. I've done that many times again. Look for opportunities to learn. Look for opportunities to upskill. Look for opportunities to streamline your practice through technology. Nobody can take that away. It's portable skills. You will survive and thrive in any economy, I guarantee it.
Words of wisdom.
I was going to say, those are good words of wisdom. That's a good ending point, I think.
Yeah. Well, Olga Mack, we both appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk with us today.
Thank you, Marlene. Thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Marlene, it's always good to talk with Olga. I was glad she could make it onto the show. The one thing that my favorite takeaway from talking with her was her comment on how skills are something that you take with you and no one can take away from you. You know, that's just a great way of thinking about, I don't want to say your value, but your skill set, and that's yours. And it doesn't matter what path your career it takes. Yeah. And so, I mean, you can take that from job to job.
Of course. Absolutely. I mean, you can't think of, well, just because I'm no longer at this job doesn't mean that I don't have my skills anymore. I mean, that's silly. I'll add to yours. Another thing that I liked is that, you know, she feels that it's really important to be genuine and to really sort of be your genuine self. And I think we've had that theme, with Kat Moon and with Brian Parker and, you know, with numerous other guests about, you know, you got to be your real self in order to really shine at what you do. And so, and Olga is definitely, she definitely embraces that. And so I really appreciated it. Before we go, we want to remind listeners to take the time to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Rate and review us as well. If you have comments about today's show or suggestions for a future show, you can reach us on Twitter at GayBauerM or at Glambert, or you can call the Geek and Review hotline at 713-487-7270 or email us at geekandreviewpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
All right. Thanks, Jerry. We'll talk to you later, Marlene.
All right. Bye. Stay dry. Don't have to